Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with a kind of review, summary, and critique of an earthbreaking speech by Dr. Kevin Anderson, scientist and deputy director of the Tyndall Center in Britain. Speaking to the Cabot Institute in Bristol in early November, Anderson told the sold-out crowd, scientists and bureaucrats cannot bring themselves to tell the public the awful truth about climate change. Anderson also leaves aside the whole issue of natural climate feedbacks that could dramatically add more carbon dioxide and methane to our atmosphere. He's a specialist in energy, even working in that field for companies like Shell Oil in the past. In this speech, Dr. Anderson takes us on a straight path through the impacts of our fossil fuel extraction and burning, and just that alone. He acknowledges there may be much more, but he says science knows too little about them at this time. We can think, for example, about recent science finding methane coming from the Siberian seabed and from the warming waters along the east coast of North America. Other studies in speeches already broadcast on Radio EcoShock show that melting permafrost in the Arctic and subarctic could add far more greenhouse gases than all our fossil fuel burning. Rob Hopkins, founder of the Transition Town movement in the UK, did a written interview with Kevin Anderson in his blog Transition Culture. It was published on November 2, 2012. In the comments, we find this compact addition to the warming forces Kevin Anderson did not cover, and it's written by the Wales farmer Lewis Cleverdon. Kevin Anderson said, "Rapid and deep emissions reductions may not be easy, but 4 degrees centigrade to 6 degrees centigrade will be much worse." In the comments at transitionculture.org, Lewis Cleverdon writes, "I'm sorry to say this presents a false dichotomy, and doubly sorry to hear it from one of Anderson's standing. Taking a credible best case for emissions reduction of getting to near zero output by 2050, regardless of whether that is by personal virtue demonstrations suddenly sweeping the whole world, or by determined popular global efforts at steering the politics to achieve an equitable and efficient global climate treaty, or by the latter adamantly supported by the former, we are going to emit enough greenhouse gases by 2050 for at least 0.6 degrees centigrade of further warming. Adding to this 0.7 degree of warming, now time-lagged in the pipeline of ocean thermal inertia, plus 0.8 degrees of warming already realized would give us 2.1 degrees centigrade of warming as a total, but for one critical factor. Ending our fossil fuel emissions means ending those of fossil sulfate, which maintain the sulfate parasol that veils the planet. As Hansen and Sato reported, the loss of the sulfate parasol will mean a rise of warming by 110%, within a margin of 30%, raising the projected 2.1 degrees centigrade to a total of 4.4 centigrade. That would be realized by about 2080 due to the time lag of around 30 years after 2050. Our best case for emissions control would thus give us between 3.8 degrees centigrade and 5 degrees centigrade of warming. However, there is a further critical factor, Lewis Cleverdon writes, namely that of the interactive mega-feedbacks, of which at least 6 are already accelerating, and several have the potential to dwarf anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions. The most advanced of these, cryosphere decline, the loss of snow and ice cover, causing an albedo loss, the reflection of the sun, is reportedly already causing warming equivalent to around 30% of our CO2 emissions. This feedback alone is nearing the capacity to offset the 43% average annual intake of our CO2 output by the natural carbon sinks, and there he's talking about the ocean. Lewis Cleverdon continues, "In the next 68 years between now and 2080, under our best-case emissions control, those feedbacks would have continuously intensifying warming to drive their interactions and outputs far beyond any possibility of our control. Under this scenario, we should certainly have substantially more than 5 degrees of warming in 2080, and warming would then continue at a pace dictated by the interactive feedbacks. Arguments over emissions control via personal virtue or via collective political action for the global climate treaty are thus missing the point. Even the best case of emissions control is patently not remotely commensurate with our predicament." Lewis Cleverdon goes on to say only geoengineering to increase our albedo effect namely by spraying sulfur particles into the air to brighten clouds and thus turn away some solar energy, only that could possibly save us. The main point here is this. Kevin Anderson's speech sticks to the simple math of our fossil fuel trajectory. That alone promises to take us to at least 4 degrees hotter and possibly much more if we don't act immediately. The mega feedbacks and the warming hidden by pollution loom as even greater shadows over this already dark picture. In his November 6th speech in Bristol, United Kingdom, Anderson warns again and again, we allow ourselves to be fooled year after year.
There's nothing left for a 40% chance of exceeding 2 degrees C. There's nothing left for us. If we asked the poor parts of the world to really pull out all stops, we would have to stop putting any emissions out in at least 2010 to give us an outside chance of avoiding what we've defined internationally as dangerous climate change that we've all signed up to, that we pass international negotiations on, that we pass our own domestic legislation on. We never even bother thinking about any of this, and the scientists stay quiet. That's a peak in 2010 coming down. I mean, I like engineering. I think you can do a lot. As an engineer, given a good spec, you can produce a lot, but you can't have an infinite rate of reduction. And in this case, it'd be even more than that because you've got to do it in the past. So they almost succeeded that recently with that neutrino experiment, but I gather it didn't work. So how come this, I would argue this is completely premised on Hadley center type analysis. All the standard science feeds into this. We're not using any tipping point issues, no discontinuities. It's all the standard analysis that feeds into everyone else's sets of emission scenarios. So why is it we've come to such fundamentally different conclusions? I'm going to think about this graphically, and it's actually quite important, this, I think, to get a handle on how much we've deliberately twisted the debate. What emissions are there for 2 degrees C? You know, what budgets are we going to use for 2 degrees C? Because there's a lot of scientific uncertainty there. So let's just quickly look at those. And remember, what I'm trying to say here is the scientific community repeatedly underplays the story. That's what I'm trying to show here. It's very unpopular with some of my colleagues. The Stern Report, for those of you familiar with, looking at current rates. Now, the Stern Report was published in 2006, so he had the data up to 2006, including his researchers, and it wasn't without a few pounds in writing the report. And I have a lot of time for the report, except for the numbers. But I like the ethos around discount, I think, was really important. And he got mostly criticised for that by the economists. But in terms of these numbers, he had the growth rate of CO2e at 0.95% per annum from 2000 to 2006. Think about that. That's that angle of the curve going up. But the real data was 2.4% per annum. That's a massive difference. Now, that's not a difference in the prediction. That data was available and was collected by governments and submitted to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and CIDIAC and all the other great people who collect this data. Anyone could have got the data off the web for nothing. But instead, we used the 0.95% per annum. And actually, loads of climate models, just emission models, have just done this. They continually use an extrapolation of 1990 optimistic trends. They don't bother checking the real data. And the scientists say nothing. So an error of 250%. And that would fundamentally change the subsequent analysis in the Stern Report. And what does the scientific community say? Absolutely nothing. Just stay quiet.
The American scientists are playing the same incredible game, pretending world emissions peaked sometime in the past.
The United States Climate Change Science Program 2007, that's when it came out. So these are where it came out, and they're assuming a 2010 peak. Ackerman, report came out in 2009, had global emissions peak in 2010. We contacted them about this. We didn't get a particularly satisfactory email. The Hume report came out in 2010, had emissions peak in 2010. But, you know, that's challenging. Peaking in the past, you know, and I'd say the neutrino didn't work. Peaking in the past, Hansen, 2008 report, had emissions peak in 2005 in that report. Nordhaus, and these are sort of two ends of the spectrum on climate change, in a 2010 report had emissions peak in 2005. Now, if they were abstract analysis, fine, but what they then do is they then give policy recommendations on the back of those. Look at those reports, you'll see policy recommendations. So a policy recommendation premised on owning a TARDIS. And then this is what we then develop our policies from. This happens repeatedly. What do the scientists say? Nothing.
Radio EcoShock.
Every big report assumes we will rescue ourselves by sucking CO2 out of the air by some magic as yet undiscovered technology assembled almost instantly on a massive scale. It's geoengineering. It's the technical fix.
But the bit that we do manipulate is that most analysis out there now, low carbon analysis, assumes we can suck the CO2 out of the air. So they almost all have geoengineering in there, negative emissions technologies. And almost without exception, what they mean is actually grow biomass, combust it in a power station, and then put the gas back underground, the carbon dioxide underground. They pretty much all have that in there. So they're sucking the CO2 out of the air, or large numbers of them. And that's used in report after report they use the negative emissions in there. So they're ubiquitous in low carbon scenarios that we use geoengineering. We've never succeeded in geoengineering at any scale. So we're putting something in place that we assume will work, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Then the other thing is, what size of the budget do we use? Well, the Hadley Centre, the UK's premier modelling centre in this area, and one of the leading model groups in the world, for around about 2°C future, they gave to the IPCC, they gave a figure of 1,400 billion tonnes of carbon that we could dump in the atmosphere over the century. And the Committee on Climate Change and the government's choice is to go for 2,900 gigatons. Just look at the difference. One's almost twice as high as the other. So we're also changing what area under the curve we can use by changing those probabilities. So little tweaks here and there allow you to all sorts of ways to massage what you're doing. Now, the other bit I want to talk about briefly, and I think this is really quite worrying, this is the split between the poor parts and the wealthy parts of the world. So if you imagine that, you know, the wealthy parts of the world are doing this, and the poor parts of the world, their emissions have been doing this. And the point is, when do they cross? When they cross is a really important point. The United States Climate Change Science Programme, this is the language it used meaning, this is a really important document in the States. We have something similar in the UK. Used meaningful and plausible, that's their quote, reference scenarios from a prospectus of highly regarded integrated assessment models, which basically is when scientists come together with economists and produce something that's expensive. I am, at the moment, very unconvinced that they have any. I think they're actually more dangerous than any good they provide. The geoengineering issue is really important. Now, not to say that we can't do it, but we haven't done it. We have very few pilots that are even moving anywhere near this direction at the moment. And the one that pretty much everyone uses is biomass and carbon capture and storage. You grow the plants, you burn it in the power station, and then you take the flue gases out and you put them deep in some reservoir somewhere, an old gas reservoir or an oil reservoir. It's worth noting there's not one large-scale carbon capture and storage power station in the world. There's some moderate-sized ones, well, hardly moderate, some small plants around the world now. There's nothing large anywhere on the planet at the moment. There are big issues about food and biodiversity with biomass. So we're going to be growing this biomass. If you look at shipping, it thinks it's going to use biomass. The car industry thinks it's going to use biomass. The aviation industry thinks it's going to use biomass. The power sector thinks it's going to use biomass. And we're going to use biomass here as well to put underground. Everyone's thinking they're using it. Every biomass scenario out there has a lot of coal CCS. Is there enough space out there to put all this carbon dioxide is a reasonable question to ask.
Let's tune into a longer passage from Dr. Kevin Anderson as he spoke at the Cabot Institute at the University of Bristol on November 6th. This was recorded from the webcast by myself, Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. You can download the whole speech from our show blog at ecoshock.info or from our website at ecoshock.org.
These are hardwired to the assumptions. What we're doing is we're pretending we're exploring the future and we're just hardwiring them depending on what our paymasters tell us, broadly. And I think that is not the way that science should be done. And let me be quite specific about that. I'm talking about the people doing the emissions modelling here, not about most of the scientists who work on climate change, but that particular group, the group that I engage with, and I'm one of. So with few exceptions, the scenarios out there, they hide or they massage historical emissions. So they change the framing of where we are today. That happens repeatedly. They always underestimate short-term growth out to the peak in emissions. That happens, again, pretty much with every scenario out there. The peak choice is Machiavellian at best. No one thinks we're going to peak in 2016, and yet every model will peak in 2016, because that gives you a nice answer for your policymaker. The reduction rates are dictated by the astrologists, so you're just told what you've got to come off the curve at. Geoengineering is assumed to work. I'm not saying it won't work, but we should have scenarios that some include it, that some don't, and probably only very few of them should include it. The split between the poor and the wealthy parts, annex one and non-annex one, is pretty much either neglected or hidden. Great big assumptions about big technologies. And as someone who used to work offshore, I like big technologies, but they're not quick to roll out, and they're not like they are in the textbooks. So you don't get the efficiencies they give you in the textbooks. You know, the real world of big technology is very different from the textbook world. And actually, the economists have nothing to add to this, not the neoclassicals, because this is a non-marginal world. This is a world where we are changing things so rapidly at such fast rates. The theories that most neoclassical economists do, market economists use, are based on marginal analysis. So it would be like using Newton to understand subatomic particles. You would not apply the theories of neoclassical marginal analysis, market analysis, to understand step change issues that we're talking about here. You wouldn't apply Newton to understand subatomic particles. And yet we continue to do that. There's a real arrogance in that. And we also still think, we have a magician's view, I'd say, of time here. We think the bull can meander into the China shop, trash everything around it, come out, and we'll wander in with some super glue, and it'll look just like it did before. That's what we think about the planet, that we somehow can do all this, reverse ourselves out of it, and then fix it, which is quite an arrogant position to take and doesn't fit with any of the science that we know around these issues. So why is all this the case? Why have we got this political creed around 2 degrees C? These are some quotes. I'm putting these into paper, and I informed the people that I've used these quotes. I haven't said who they're from. This is a very senior colleague of mine. I have a lot of time for him. Very senior political scientist. Advises the government a lot of the time. I spoke to him in 2010 after an event all about 2 degrees C stuff. And he said, too much has been invested in 2 degrees C for us to say it is not possible. It would undermine all that's been achieved. It gives a sense of hopelessness that we may as well just give in. These are the exact words. This is my asking a question then. Are you suggesting we have to lie about our research findings? Well, perhaps just be not so honest, more dishonest. So that's from a political scientist who really understands this terrain of climate change policy and science. This is a senior government advisor who won't say who it is. We can't tell them, ministers and politicians, it's impossible. We can say it's a stretch and ambitious, but then with political will, 2 degrees C is still feasible. Even when you're probably at 3 and 4 degrees C and swimming around in you know, sea level rise, we can still tell the ministers 2 degrees C is possible. So, I mean, he actually said that in a public place, so I won't. I could name him, but I won't. Right, that's the Department of Energy and Climate Change. That's Ed Miliband. The day before he went to Copenhagen, I had a 20-minute meeting with him in Manchester before he got the ferry the following day. And he said, this was the Secretary of State for the Department for Energy and Climate Change. Our position is challenging enough. I can't go with the message that 2 degrees C is impossible. It's what we've all worked towards. So across the board, everyone's saying we can't be honest about 2 degrees C. I was at an event recently, a Chatham House event, so I can't tell you who was there, but a very senior government scientist and someone very senior from a company, an oil company, that looks like something you might find at the beach. These very senior people said, well, I think we're on for 4 to 6 degrees C, but we just can't be open about it. That is going on all the time behind the scenes, that somehow we can't tell the public. It's exactly the opposite, say, of what the... Well, it's what the sceptics say, but exactly the opposite direction. So where does all of this leave us? If it all looks too difficult, then what about a 4 degrees C future? And there are some of you here that will learn a lot more about this than me, but just I'm using some numbers here based on Hadley Centre and some other people's analysis. It's very simple, some set of assumptions here, but I think it's important to think about a 4 degrees C future. If we peak by 2020, we come down off the curve at 3.5% per annum, the sort of stuff we've been talking about, we can hold the 4 degrees C. 4 degrees C is doable. Challenging, but doable. So I'd say it's achievable. So it is aiming for 4 degrees C more realistic. And certainly I was at an event the other day and someone said, I can't see what's wrong with 4.6. Why don't we just carry on aiming for that sort of temperature? He was a very wealthy American. But yeah, you know, I'm sure there's lots of other people who say the same thing. That somehow a lot of us think we can defend ourselves against this sort of changed world. Maybe some of us can. 4 degrees C global mean surface temperature. You're probably talking about 5 to 6 as your land temperature. Because remember, a lot of the global temperature is held down by the thermal inertia of the oceans. So the oceans themselves actually keep the Earth cooler. So if the global average is 4, then the land temperatures on average will be higher than that. But you see very large regional variations, and that's what really matters, are these regional variations. And let's be blunt about that again. The science is really very, very uncertain on this. This is an area that really needs a lot more work. So if we think of the stuff this is stuff that came out of Hadley Centre, look at the hottest days of the year. So think of the 2003 heatwave in 2003 heatwave in Europe. Just think of China and Beijing and Shanghai. If you look at the buildings that are going up there and other parts of the world as well, during their hottest days of the year, you'd have a 6 to 8 degrees C temperature rise. And that could last, remember, for quite a long time. So the hottest days of the year with a 4 degrees C global average. Imagine the 2003 heatwave. Imagine that we knocked on top of that 8 to 10 degrees C. Now, somewhere between 20,000 and 30,000 people died during that. We've got Victorian infrastructures. Our tubes won't work. You know, there's lots of the things will not work in that sort of world. We're not being designed or for that sort of future. Certainly not with the populations that we have and the urban heat island effect on top of it. 10 to 12, 12 degrees in New York. I mean, these are high, really very high temperatures that you just simply, our infrastructures and the way that we live our lives could not deal with these things. And you remember in London, is it three days food? And this could be a good thing. There's 3 days food in London. At those sorts of temperatures, you may find there's no transport network. So in 3 days, you know, things won't be working. And your fridges probably won't work because your air conditioning units will be blasting away. So you'll probably be blowing the fuses on the grid. So, yeah, this is not a world that we know how to contemplate. And at 4 degrees C, if you think of it, in lower latitudes, the estimates are that you see significant reductions, 30, 40% reductions in some of the staple crops, maize and rice and so forth. At the same time, the population is heading towards 9 billion. So this is the sort of 4 degrees C world. And I mentioned that, you know, some people I do know here will know a lot more about this than me, and if they take this similar view, this is my anecdotal polling of climate scientists who work in this sort of area. I said there's a widespread view that a 4 degrees C future is incompatible with the organised global community as we see it today, particularly going forward with 9 billion people and all the other stresses that we face. It's likely to be beyond adaptation. There's lots of this. We will not be able to be able to adapt to the impacts. We'll just get hit by the impacts. Some of us might be able to adapt, but many people won't. And it's devastating for the majority of ecosystems. Ecosystems always change, but this is a very, very fast rate of change. And that ecosystems probably are not tuned to changing at this sort of rate of change. And also there's quite a high probability of this not being stable. Many scientists would suggest as you head towards these temperatures, you get other feedbacks kicking in. Some people call them tipping points, non-linearities. I think we mustn't overplay what we know about those. We don't know when they're going to occur. What we do know is the higher the temperature, the more likely it is that they'll occur. So a prudent person would perhaps keep the temperature rise low. And then it would go up to some other temperature, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, wherever it might stabilise out at. But again, these are things I think there's still a lot of science to do. So I would say, I'd go as far as say 4 degrees C, we should avoid at all costs.
Don't despair, Anderson tells us. We are the very people who can do something to save the climate right now.
Now, before we despair, this is all a sort of message of doom and gloom. What can we do about it? What can we in this room, what can other people, policymakers, what can we do from the bottom up, what can we do from the top down about this? Is anyone still awake? There's a little bit of good news coming up. I'll try and whip through this a bit quicker. Just to give you a handle, this is the sort of reductions that we need to see in the wealthy parts of the world. This is for an outside chance of 2 degrees C. We need to have about 10% per annum, if not a bit more than that, really, from energy. So we need about 40% reduction in the next 3 years in our energy consumption. That's all of our energy consumption, not just the bits you want to measure. That includes planes, that includes ships. 40%. A 70% reduction by 2020, and basically be completely decarbonised by 2030. Fridges, planes, ships, cars, everything we do. Projectors, power system, everything. Decarbonised. To give a little bit of space for the poorer parts of the world to help them develop and improve their welfare. So that's what we'd have to try and do. And that we'll all say that that's impossible. But the question I was asked, which you probably can't see at the back, is then, is living with 4 degrees C temperature rise by 2050 to 2070, is that less impossible? The future is impossible. Which as an academic I quite like, because it means you would think lots of research grants saying, well, how can we make the impossible possible? We don't get that. We just say, how can we incrementally twiddle with this system again? But, whatever you do, the mitigation future is impossible and the adaptation future is impossible. And that we've got ourselves in that position tough. You know. We've done nothing about climate change since Rio, and we've knowingly done that. So are there any things that can move us in the right direction? The first one of these I'm going to talk about is agency, and the second one is about, equity, and the second one is technology. I'll whip through these quite quickly. This is just a guideline, but there's 7 billion people on the planet. Who needs to make a change? It's not about population. Climate change is not about population. Climate change is about a small group of people, and we know who they are. We see them when we shave, when we put makeup on, we see them in the mirror. So sustainability is a 7 billion person issue. Climate change is not, because it's about the next 10 day to 10 years, really. Vilfredo Pareto is an Italian economist. 80-20 rule I use this in engineering for years is just called the rule of thumb. 80% of something relates to 20% of those involved. This is just a guide, and there's some background to this information now. 80% of emissions from 20% of the population. Run that 3 times. In other words, do the same thing again with that particular group there. Do the 80-20 rule again in that, and do it again, and you get about 50% of the world's emissions come from 1% of the population. Now, some of the other estimates out there, this is for energy. That if you include food, that it might be about 5% of the emissions come from 50% of the population. But actually, food is more evenly spread, because we all eat roughly the same. The peasant and the pauper and the prince eat roughly the same in terms of food, but they don't have the same in terms of energy. So roughly as a guide, 40-60% of the emissions come from 1 to 5% of the population. And we know who they are. Who's in the 1 to 5%? Well, I don't know if you're all in there, but the sort of audiences I normally engage with, every climate scientist is in there with it. There might be an exception somewhere, but hard to find. Every journalist and pontificator and skeptic, and every other OECD academic, anyone who gets on a plane once a year, and if you have to 30K a year, which most students are, and probably some of you will probably earn that much money, then you're probably in that category already. So we're the major emitters. We know who they are. There's no one else to blame. And that includes me. So the question then is, are people like us, the Annex 1 people, but including, of course, about 300 million people who live wealthy lives in China, 300 million, roughly the same population as the slightly smaller EU was. Are we prepared to make changes to our lives now or have them enforced upon us? Or are we prepared to hand over to our children or even later on in our lives a much, much higher climate change future? So there's a lot that we can do. We don't require the whole world to do something. We require a small proportion of the world to change what they do today for the next 10 or 20 years while we put low carbon supply in place. Then we can go back to our old profligate lifestyles, except for there's some sustainability concerns that might step in. But from a time perspective, climate change is a short-term issue that we have to deal with, and that's why it's not about population.
Here's how Kevin Anderson, as much a human as a scientist, ends this talk at the University of Bristol.
This is actually what got through in the paper, the World Science paper. This is not meant as a message of futility, as it often said, it was just futile. It's a wake-up call of where our rose-tinted spectacles have brought us. Real hope And that's the only thing I'm interested in. Real hope, if it is to arise at all, real action, real hope, if it is to arise at all, will do so from a bare assessment of the scale of the challenge that we now face. And that's what I've tried to show here. This is where we are today. If we know where we are today, we know what the scale of the problem is. If as scientists we keep underplaying it, we don't know it. And I'll leave you with a quote from Robert Unger that I always finish off with. At every level, the greatest obstacle to transforming the world is we lack the clarity and imagination to conceive that it could be different. Clarity and imagination, that's what we need. Lots more of that. And then I think we could actually deal with climate change to a degree. Thank you very much.
It's likely this exposé of sweetened climate projections with known bad numbers and reassuring official talk could be my speech of the year. Now go ahead, you've got the tools you need to take another hour out of your life to hear the truth about climate change. Download the November 6th speech by Professor Kevin Anderson at the Cabot Institute, either from my show blog at ecoshock.info or from the Radio EcoShock website at ecoshock.org. Listen, learn, worry, and rededicate yourself to change before the new out-of-control climate changes everything and everyone we love. Thank you for taking the time and having the courage to listen this week. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. All music on this program is by Suvarna, with her co-conspirator Ravi and guest Egyptian percussionist Hossam Ramzi. The album is Energia on Erythrean Records. Suvarna, a world music maker, has another couple of albums with White Swan Records. We'll end this Radio EcoShock show with a special single she sent to our program. It's Dead On. The song is Atmosphere's Lament. Thank you.